Well, hello there. Welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region, which I've reviewed in the Hürriyet Daily News. You can subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can follow via the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page or my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can also support the podcast via my Patreon account, making a monetary donation, small or large, on a per episode basis. Find details of all that via all the Turkey Book Talk pages or via my website. Now on with the show. And in this episode, I speak to Umut Uzer from Istanbul Technical University. He's the author of a new book, An Intellectual History of Turkish Nationalism Between Turkish Ethnicity and Islamic Identity, published by the University of Utah Press. The book explores the many varied flavors of nationalism in Turkey, from the past right up to the present day. Turkish nationalism developed relatively late compared to other nationalisms in the Ottoman Empire, and I started by asking Umut Uzer why that was the case.
As rulers of the Ottoman Empire, following a policy of Turkish nationalism would not have made sense because that would have brought in the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire, which was, as all empires, as a multinational empire. The identity was more at the state level for some intellectuals. That is the Ottoman form of statehood and Ottoman national affiliation on the part of many intellectuals in the Ottoman Empire. And for the less educated, I think their affiliation was more at the local level, be it at the town level or the village level, or religious affiliation. So there was no strong national identity, even the Ottoman territorial identity, which could be compared to the American form of national identity, was rather restricted. I mean, it wasn't really a mass movement. It only was supported by the Ottoman elite, and it never became a hegemonic identity either. So for Turks, the eruption of Turkish nationalism, I think, came rather late in the 19th century, if not early 20th century. And I think we did not have an hegemonic form of Turkish nationalism until the coming of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in 1923. So I think in the advent of Turkish nationalism, I think we can talk about a number of issues. One of them was separatism on the part of minorities in the Ottoman Empire, their quest to establish their own nation states, first in the Balkans, then in the Middle East. It was a reaction to that, to those kind of separatist national movements or national liberation movements on the part of Christian and then the Muslim peoples of the Ottoman Empire. And the second aspect was scholarly studies on Turkish history and Turkish languages that started in Western Europe as well as in Russia. That also had an influence on Turkish educated elite. And the fact that the Ottomans were losing territories, ever since the late 18th century, also made Turkish nationalism one of the most viable options for the creation of a nation state. And Turkish was rather common at the literary level, at least at the school level, in what was left of the Ottoman Empire. And the biggest question, of course, was what to do with the large Arab community in the Middle East, because the Ottoman state only lost the Arab lands at the end of World War I. So because of these dilemmas and because of these questions, Turkish nationalism has not become hegemonic during the time of the Ottoman Empire. Even though the Young Turks are presented by many scholars or other people as a Turkish nationalist movement, that I think that is rather problematic, because they used Turkish nationalism was one of the factions, one of the ideas within the movement, but so was Ottomanism, so was Islamism, so was Westernism. And I think the top leaders, at least two of them, Enver Pasha included, seem to have gravitated towards Ottomanism and Islamism, as we can see in his letters to his wife and some of his policies. I mean, just because Enver Pasha, he died in Central Asia, in what is known as Turkestan, many people have a tendency in Turkey as well to see him as a pan-Turkist or a Turkish nationalist. I think that is highly problematic because, it was, as I said, one of the ideas that was common within the Young Turks, the political party, being the Committee of Union and Progress, but it was never hegemonic as people argue. But when we read other scholars like Carter Findlay, he openly says, you know, we should question that Turkish nationalism was the dominant idea among Young Turks, which it was not. So even in the last days of the Ottoman Empire, I don't think we can say that Turkish nationalism was the official ideology of the state. Not at all. It was only during the time of Atatürk that it became the official ideology of modern Turkey.
And you talk about how the early development of Turkish nationalism, the influence of Muslim emigres from the Russian Empire to the Ottoman Empire was very important. But I think that fact is not too well known by most people. So what was their influence?
Yes, I mean, their influence was rather important. And we're talking about Turkic immigrants coming from the Tsarist Russia, be it from Azerbaijan, be it from Crimea or Kazan, less so from Central Asia proper. I think the reason was that the areas that I mentioned, like the Caucasus, Crimea and Kazan, have been more economically developed than Central Asia proper because of oil and trade and other reasons. These regions, people in these regions, at least the educated people, seem to have been more interested in nationalism and modernization. And I think we need to emphasize that too, both in these regions, in Russia, among the Turkic peoples of Russia, as well as in Ottoman Turkey. I think Turkish nationalism started out as a modern ideology, putting emphasis on women's rights, interestingly, you know, giving them equal rights and modern education. All these ideas were rather common and prevalent among Turkish nationalists during these days. And this seems to have established, this is contradictory to what Turkish nationalism has become from the 1950s onwards, as far as Turkey is concerned, that is. So these emigres, they were involved in Russian politics, be it in the Caucasus or even in the center. They became members of the parliament, members of Duma, the Russian parliament. So they were rather active politically. They were rather aware of what was happening in Russia, in the Ottoman Empire, as well as in Western Europe. They knew a lot of languages, including their local Turkic languages, including the Ottoman Turkish, Russian and French and German and others. I mean, we can give a lot of names, but so they were rather well-educated and politically active in Russia and later in the Ottoman Empire. So for some reason in Turkey as well, we don't know much about them. I mean, they're not really mentioned that much. Is it because of some territorial jealousy or whatever? We don't know, but we can think about Yusuf Akçura. He was the head of the Turkish Historical Society. And he was rather active in Turkish national politics. He never had a problem with the leader Atatürk. So he was able to be rather influential within Turkey. But whereas others seem to have disagreements as far as Turkish history was concerned with Mustafa Atatürk. So some of them had to leave, or some of them were involved in nationalistic politics. And they were arrested in after Atatürk's time in 1944. But their expertise in history, their political activism back in Russia, their education in Western Europe, many of them in France and other places, I think has contributed both ideologically and academically to the idea of Turkish nationalism and modernization and women's rights in Ottoman Turkey. And they were not as influenced by religion as the Turkish elite in Ottoman Turkey. So they had an easier, more liberal attitude towards issues such as women's rights and the role of religion, ethnicity, and the like. So their contribution was rather significant, and we could definitely mention their contribution to the rise of Turkish nationalism in Turkey as one of the important aspects, in addition to these academic studies, in addition to the political developments in the Ottoman Empire, losing of territory. But their contribution was significant. But we also need to say that it wasn't a one-way street. Of course, the Ottoman Turkish intellectuals also influenced their ideas in the Caucasus among Azerbaijani Turks especially. And in fact, the Azerbaijani Turkish identity was rather strong in the beginning of the 20th century up until 1920s. Whereas today, looking from the 21st century, I think Azerbaijani Turkish identity is not dominant anymore. I mean, there's definitely that identity there. But also the territorial identity of being Azerbaijani seems to be more important, at least at the official level.
Now, Turkish nationalism is an extremely potent force, and it has many different flavors in all ideological strands in Turkey, from left to right, secular to religious ideologies. So how did you want to address this broad sweep throughout the book?
Well, it is my book is to a large extent a textual analysis of the important nationalist thinkers from the late 19th century until the 21st century, but we don't seem to have many nationalist intellectuals anymore for the past few decades. There is the element of nationalism in many political ideologies, be it the left or the right, but just because there's an element of nationalism, I wouldn't consider that political movement or ideology as nationalistic. I mean, for instance, today there's a tendency to call the ruling government to be nationalistic, or the 1970s leftist movements as nationalistic because of their anti-imperialism, anti-Americanism, their ideas about full independence, just like Atatürk used the term. So there are elements of nationalism, but I would argue a political movement or an ideology as nationalistic if, in what I call as the hierarchy of loyalties, the nation is at the top. So if your loyalty is to the nation, not necessarily religion or not necessarily class, then I would definitely call that political movement as a nationalistic movement, or that person, that ideologue, as nationalistic. Of course, I mean, these are ideas. I mean, we can talk about ideal types, but we can talk about reality where ideas are more eclectic. You know, there's the element of religion. There can be element of anti-imperialism or anti-colonialism as far as the left is concerned. Of course, the ideological odyssey of this idea of Turkish nationalism is the topic of the book. How it has changed from a more modern, pro-Western, even you might say a progressive idea, into a more conservative, patriarchal idea in the 1950s. And of course, Turkish nationalism has become a conservative idea in the 1950s with a combination of nationalistic ideas as far as, in addition to that, also religious conservative references to the Ottoman Empire. And in 1969, as the Nationalist Action Party was established, it became a Turkish Islamic national movement. So when people think about nationalism in the country, people think about a conservative movement. But the early precursors, the early ideologues of nationalism were not necessarily conservative. So that's something contemporary nationalists find it difficult to accept, even as far as, say, Ottomanism is concerned, or the reference to the Ottoman Empire. One of the important Turkish nationalists, Ziya Gökalp, who died in 1924, even though he did not make a total break with his past, with Turkish past, with Ottoman past, with Islam, he was quite revolutionary for his time. I mean, he called for Turkish prayers, rejection of the Sultan. So all these things are rather curious for later nationalists, because they seem to have a more sympathy towards the Ottoman history, as well as more sympathy towards religion as well. So we do have elements of nationalism in different parties, in different movements, but I think it has become less and less in the country. This has become just one of the tools to mobilize the masses, but I don't think it is that important, especially in the ruling party. The question of nationalism so far has been rather weak, even though from time to time, and recently we see it more often, the ruling elite try to use certain elements of nationalism as tools against Europe or against justification of their rule or legitimacy of their rule. But I would argue that it's not an extremely strong idea. And that brings us to the question of different kinds of nationalism. Of course, there are different kinds of nationalism. I have a number of categories in the book, including conservative nationalism, which explains the ideology of the Turkish Nationalist Action Party, MHP, but also earlier nationalism, as the official Kemalist nationalism, which had been more secular and more pro-Western, and also a very minority form of nationalism, the ethnic nationalism, which was rather racist, but it never became hegemonic in any major political party, including the MHP. So that was a minority idea, you know, ethnic nationalism, racism. But I think the two clashing nationalisms, or the two different nationalisms that we have in Turkey, are the more Western style, more secular form of nationalism, and the more conservative form of nationalism. But I would also exclude the ruling party from that form of nationalism as well.
And you narrate that big shift that sort of took place in the 1950s from Kemalist to conservative nationalism. And that has been a schism that has kind of continued since then. But at the time, first of all, what were the precursors, what were the causes of this shift? And secondly, how did the Cold War reinforce Turkish nationalism? Because I think from this distance, we kind of forget how anti-communism was so important for the retrenchment of ultra-nationalism in Turkey. It's easy to forget that when, you know, it's not a potent force anymore. But at the time, it was, you know, the number one sort of calling card of Turkish nationalists.
Yes, the 1950s, the first important development was the coming of democracy to the country in 1950. So even though the cadres of the Democratic Party, which came to power in 1950, came from the precursor, the Republican People's Party, JHP, they seem to have mobilized the masses with a number of ideas and slogans, and that included religion and nationalism, a more different, more conservative form of nationalism. They seem to have made their peace with the desires of the common folk. So they tried to offer a different form of understanding, even though looking from today's perspective, they seemed pretty Western, pro-Western, quite secular. But at a discourse level, especially Prime Minister Menderes used a lot of Islamic slogans. He used Islamic politics, but at a secular, at a legal level, of course, the secular system was kept, was preserved during that era. But yet, in the 1950s, we have a number of processes that were important in the change of this form of nationalism and Turkish politics. One was democratization. The other one was the urbanization, the increasing number of people coming from the provinces to the major cities in Western Turkey, including the capital in Central Turkey, obviously. And with that, we see the desires and the interests of the provincial people coming to the center and being more acceptable, even at governmental circles, even at least at the discourse level. And of course, the interesting thing about the Cold War was that it brought an alliance of all these different kinds of people, be it the more conservative nationalists, more conservative people, even the Islamists. They had a common aim to fight against the Soviet Union. So in that form, the Democratic Party had old-style Kemalists, but also even people who could be called Islamists or conservative nationalists, some of whom were expelled from the party because of their extreme use of language against Atatürk and whatnot. But yes, anti-communism and anti-Soviet and anti-Russian feelings definitely put these people together. And their differences seem to have mattered less in those days because the major threat, major source of concern was the Soviet Union. And Russia, we have to keep in mind, was the enemy of the Ottoman Empire for many decades, you know, first snatching Crimea from the Ottomans in the late 18th century, but also gaining more territory in the Balkans, in the Caucasus, and even coming all the way to eastern Turkey during late in the 19th century, also during World War I. So Russia had been the enemy, so to speak, and reincarnated as the Soviet Empire. So that was a major concern that brought all these different elements together. Anti-communism, there were associations for the struggle against communism. They were established throughout Turkey. So that was definitely one of the common themes among the rightist circles. Another common theme was anti-JHP, anti-Republican People's Party. They seem to have different grudges due to numerous reasons, the 1944 racism, Turanism incident being one. So anti-JHP feeling was definitely important, was one of the important motives of Turkish political right. And also we need to keep in mind, you know, the coming of democracy made the government more open for the demands of the common people. So all these elements, I think, came together and formed a different form of Turkish politics, especially at the Turkish political right. And the creeping of Turkish conservatism within the center-right political party, the Democratic Party, as well as within the nationalist parties that became the MHP in 1969, were important developments in the 1950s. And this is something, I mean, I use a term, conservative turn. It's the name of a book about American politics by Michael Kimmage, But it is also very relevant for Turkey as well. I mean, there was a conservative turn in America in the 1950s, as well as in Turkey.
What about the question of social classes? Because we've talked a bit about how nationalism has had all these different flavors. But in when you kind of dig into these different kinds of nationalism, it's kind of clear that underpinning them are these different economic constituencies. So, you know, with the Kemalists, crudely, you have this early sort of state elite. And then later on with the conservative nationalists, you had people who were not at the center. They were kind of more provincial and had more traditional values. What about this question of different economic interests being reflected in different styles of nationalism?
I mean, I would argue that nationalism is a supra-class ideology. It's beyond class. I mean, that can be manifested in, you know, expressions and manifestations of nationalism, both in rich neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. So, I mean, that's definitely that. But on the other hand, you're right in the sense that the Kemalists seem to have been more educated, seem to have been the more the upper class, but not necessarily as it was trivialized in the last decade or so, as Kemalists as always being rich, which is not correct, because you have to look at Anatolia, which also had rather pro-Kemalist people and individuals and groups in people like Adana or in the Black Sea region. So it's not only, I mean, it wasn't only in the big cities. I mean, yes, to a large extent we can say that, but also when you look at other places like, as I said, Adana or even places like Artvin in the Black Sea or Sinop, you see elements of Kemalism among the local people too. So that is also important. So we there's definitely a crossing of classes, but in a general term, we could, yes, say that the Kemalists seem to be better educated, they seem to be richer, whereas the provincial people coming from the provincial areas seem to have identified more with either the nationalist movement of MHP as far or increasingly so with the Islamist movements and the current government. So there is definitely this class dimension, but it has been surpassed by many people as well. So we have to be careful when we say, you know, I mean, I don't think we can see it purely as a class struggle between the Kemalists and the more conservatively minded nationalists. But be that as it may, when you look at the MHP, at least in the past few decades, MHP had been more getting votes from Central Eastern Anatolia in the past. But in the past few elections, they have also moved towards the Mediterranean coast as well. So their appeal sometimes increases, sometimes comes back. But to a large extent, the MHP movement had been more confined to certain provincial areas, and they seem to be rather poor. I mean, you know, they're rather weakly represented in Istanbul. Their influence is not that strong in that big city. So as far as the class dimension, I mean, I don't look too much into that. Yes, it could definitely be a focus for a different kind of study, but my emphasis is not too much on that. But there are very complex issues as far as class is concerned, and it's something that should be taken seriously.
And obviously nationalism always requires some other to define itself against. And since the 1980s, that's mainly been the PKK and Kurdish nationalism. How has that reshaped Turkish nationalism?
Yes, I mean, you definitely need another, I mean, to define yourself. And in the Turkish case, even during the secular era of Atatürk, a Turk was implicitly defined as a Turkish-speaking Muslim. Again, what I called as a sociologically Muslim. You did not want a really practicing Muslim at the time, but still sociologically someone who would be Muslim and who would be Turkish. But that assimilation was open for other non-Turkish-speaking Muslims. But for non-Muslims, it was more difficult to be considered as a Turk, because the reason is both at the people's level and both at the governmental level, non-Muslims were not really considered as Turks, whereas people say, including Kurds or people, some of the Laz who live in certain parts of the Black Sea, nobody questioned their Turkishness. And within the Turkish nationalist movement, both in the past and today, we always have people of Kurdish background, both at MHP. I mean, some people call Ziya Gökalp as a Kurd, but that's problematic. I've written an article on that. Even because he's from Diyarbakir, many people assumed he was a Kurd. But he addressed these issues as far as his own identity is concerned. And he basically said, look, I mean, I'm not a Kurd, but I do not support a racist form of nationalism anyway. So even if I were a Kurd, that would not have mattered for me at all. But the bottom line is I'm not a Kurd. So, but yes, the PKK, not the Kurds, but the PKK was the other of Turkish nationalism. That's no doubt. Because as I said, even within the MHP, there were and there are numerous Kurds, both at the grassroots level and also at the top level. You might think about the mayor of Bingöl in eastern Turkey was from MHP in the 1970s. Or in their government in between 1992 to 2002. For instance, we had Minister of Health Osman Durmuş, who openly said that he was a Kurd. And there are other names that we can give, both at the top echelons of the party, as well as at the grassroots level. So I don't think being a Kurd and being a member of the MHP was a problem. Not for the party, not for many people of Kurdish origins. But the problem was the PKK, obviously. The party was very much against the PKK. They were against giving any political rights or cultural rights against Kurds. MHP has become a conservative movement. So in that sense, the Islamic link with the Kurds was rather important. And I think it was an important link as far as the prevention of a civil war in the country, for instance. It never became like Lebanon because, well, the overwhelming majority of the Kurds are Sunnis. And the Islamic link, I think, sort of decreased any form of ethnic conflict between the two peoples. But as far as the Alevis are concerned, they're different religious sects in Turkey. MHP, well, seemed to have a more problem, especially in the 1970s. Even though we have certain leaders of MHP, including Turkish, the leader of MHP, Alparslan Turkish, who also spoke sympathetically towards Alevis or people later on. Well, there was, because most of the Alevis were associated with the left, and the political conflict in the 1970s manifested itself both at the denomination level between Sunnis and Alevis. It was a conflict between right and left, but most of the left was supported by the Alevis. Of course, there were many Sunnis who also supported the left as well. But in general terms, some of the conflicts in certain cities in Turkey in the 1970s made MHP not an acceptable party towards the Alevis. So if MHP's problem was more towards Alevis than the Kurds, I would argue. Because, I mean, the examples I gave you are not exceptions. You know, membership in the MHP. And this is something not very well known, even within Turkey. I mean, some people think MHP is racist or MHP is anti-Kurd. That's not necessarily the case. But you're absolutely right. I mean, they're definitely anti-PKK. They do not support any form of cultural rights for the Kurds. And they're rather, in a sense, they're rather Kemalist in that sense. You know, there should be a single state with a single nation without any forms of other forms of ethnic or religious affiliations. But I mean, the fact of the matter today is MHP is almost invisible in the Kurdish areas of Turkey. I mean, that is the case. Yes, I mean, in the past, in partially Kurdish areas like Elazığ or Erzurum, I mean, these are more Turkish than Kurdish, but there's also a strong Kurdish presentation in these cities as well. MHP was rather successful in the past, but not anymore. The ruling AKP seems to have gained a lot of votes from the MHP as well in these more conservative areas. So I think, I mean, I talk about, I mean, not in the book, I don't talk about it in the book, but today I can say there are three concentric circles, I mean, between, say, MHP and AKP. There's conservatism, the Islamic link, they share that. But MHP and CHP link the secular or the Turkish identity with each other. So all these three parties, whereas CHP and AKP, I don't think they share anything together. But MHP shares both elements, certain elements with AKP, conservatism, Islamic traditional ideas and lifestyles with MHP and AKP, whereas MHP shares the Turkishness dimension with CHP. Yes, the CHP nationalism is more secular, whereas MHP nationalism is more conservative, but there are also elements that they share, especially among MHP membership in the Aegean or in Istanbul or in Ankara in the big cities.
Now, today we have the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, in power, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And obviously they've moved away from this kind of rigid ethnic definition of nationalism. And their vision is not limited to the national borders of the Turkish Republic, But they're also still using many of the tropes of Turkish nationalism. You see this increasingly kind of bellicose ideology of, you know, self-assertion and national glory over various enemies, and a very strong kind of anti-Western rhetoric in recent years. And I've been thinking, and I think perhaps the best term is kind of Ottoman nationalism, which is a bit oxymoronic, but I think it kind of captures the essence of the current government's style of nationalism.
Yeah, I might agree with that, because I mean, I always say, and most people disagree with me, both in Turkey and in Europe and elsewhere, is that I say, look, AKP is not nationalist. At least it's not Turkish nationalist, because it has been specifically mentioned by, you know, the current president and as well as the former prime minister, that they have trampled upon all forms of nationalism, that they are anti-nationalist. That Davutoğlu said this, but Erdogan said it on numerous times. They were more open to Kurdish demands, if you remember. I mean, the CHP and MHP would never have allowed so much for the Kurds. I mean, beat the Kurdish TV. Nobody seems to care about that anymore, but it was a big deal, I think. Or Kurdish departments at the universities. So because they did not have an ethnic or national or Turkish form of identity, the ruling party, they were more open towards Kurdish demands until recently. What do you say about Ottoman nationalism? We could say that, or it could be sort of Islamic Anatolian form of nationalism, or Islamic Ottoman Anatolian form of nationalism. I would agree with that. I mean, you definitely need some sort of identity. Okay, maybe it's not Turkish anymore. It's definitely not ethnic, or it's definitely not secular form of Turkishness. But yes, more affiliation towards the Ottoman Empire, putting emphasis on the Ottoman Empire, on Ottoman language, on Islam, on Anatolia. So, I mean, there's definitely, you can say Ottoman or Islamic form of nationalism. We definitely, yes, even though it might be a contradictory term, and I usually do not want to use that, we might need to use some sort of term that you suggested that might be useful to explain the present-day Turkey, because now they are the new establishment. I mean, this is the new Turkey, this is the new establishment, and the new establishment needs an identity. And interestingly, they do not mention the name of the nation anymore, right? I mean, the president say this nation or our nation, but what is the name of our nation is not that clear. Maybe it is for his mind, but he doesn't spell it out. So is it Ottoman? Definitely does the Ottoman and Islamic and Anatolian, all these elements. And it might definitely be an interesting, you know, study about, you know, what is the current form of identity in contemporary Turkey. I mean, of course, you cannot totally reject Turkishness. I mean, his criticisms of Germany and people of Turkish background who are members of the German parliament, I mean, they seemed rather nationalistic. I need to admit that, you know. But I mean, Turkishness has been discouraged, I think, for the past decade and a half. And a new form of identity, which definitely has Turkishness in it too. I mean, at least it's the language that people speak, but more emphasis on the past and maybe somewhat on the geography as well. I mean, affiliation or tendency towards the Middle East was rather important for this government, but that seems to have ended, at least because of the rejection of that region of Turkish leadership.
Just as a side note, I remember I was really struck at the end of last year when there were these pro-Erdogan protesters. Some of those protesters were using the grey wolf hand gesture, which was amazing to see, really. But it just showed how the kind of constituencies of Erdogan and the Turkish nationalist grassroots overlapped in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, yes, indeed. I mean, some of these members of the Grey Wolves of the MHP moved towards the ruling party because they seem to associate with the president. And his stand against Germany, as far as this Armenian genocide claims, can even maybe bring in more people of nationalistic background to his party and to his side. So it's definitely, I mean, he definitely has an appeal beyond his own party. I mean, MHP, I mean, we don't know the exact. Is it 25% or 40% or even more of MHP? Definitely, they do have a sympathy towards the president because of his personalistic style, his manliness and all that. And we could definitely see more people support him. But we will have to see. But yes, the overlap that I've been mentioning is definitely there. And the example you gave is also rather important, yes.
That was Umut Uzer talking about his new book, An Intellectual History of Turkish Nationalism, Between Turkish Ethnicity and Islamic Identity. You can find a link to my review of the book via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. There's also an edited transcript of this interview on there. Don't forget you can subscribe to Turkey Book Talk via iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher. If you like the podcast, please do rate it on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can like the Facebook page. And if you're feeling generous, you can support the podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Andrew Cruikshank, Özlem Bayarslan and Steve Bryant. Find links to all that on all the Turkey Book Talk pages, and in the meantime, until next time, thank you very much for listening.